seated. I'd like to welcome everyone to the Court of Appeals this morning. We thank you for being here. Before we begin, I want to introduce the panel to you. To my left is Justice Elizabeth Kerr. To my right is Justice Lee Gabriel, and I'm Bonnie Setters. I'm the Chief Justice of the Court. Before we begin, I'll ask the clerk to please call the case, the first case.
The court will now call Kiyama Statler, LP and L, versus Matthew D. Shallis and Jeffries, LLC. May it please the court, Mr. Gregory Ziegler to argue for the appellant, and Ms. Catherine Treisman to argue first for 10 minutes for the appellee, and Mr. Justin Bernstein to argue second for 5 minutes for the appellee.
You may proceed.
May it please the court, I'm Greg Ziegler, lead counsel for Appellant Fiamma. The trial court erred in granting Jeffries and Chalice's Rule 91A motion for two reasons. One, the trial court applied the wrong standard, did not apply the standard of Rule 91A. And number two, the motion was untimely. I'll spend most of my time on the first, but I do want to get to the second because I do believe the second is a case of first impression in the state. And I do believe the court needs to take up the timeliness, the merits of the timeliness argument. Rule 91A is no stranger to this court. This court has taken up nine 91A cases. Of those nine cases, most have been either pro se, well, they've all been either pro se litigants, gun range cases, or jurisdictional cases. The one case that does not fit that category is an opinion by Chief Justice Sutter in the Bedford Internet Office Space versus Texas General Insurance case, 2017 opinion. That case sets out the standard, at least the standard as it applies in the second court. As your honors are aware, the Texas Supreme Court has not necessarily addressed what has been a conflict in the courts of appeals. This court seems to have addressed that. And what am I talking about? The movement in the lower court, the appellee here, persuaded the trial court below to grant the Rule 91A motion based on a case out of the Beaumont Court of Appeals called GoDaddy. GoDaddy is wrong. GoDaddy applies the wrong standard. GoDaddy does not do what this Court of Appeals has done, in particular in Justice Sutter's opinion in Bedford Internet. GoDaddy is the sole basis for Appellee's motion and the trial court's granting of that Rule 91A motion in violation of the strict interpretation of the language of Rule 91A, which is the standard that Justice Sutter laid out for this court to apply. GoDaddy, Beaumont Court of Appeals 2014, applies a standard that is not found in Rule 91A. As your honors know, Rule 91A was enacted in 2013 by directive from the Texas legislature. In the government code, the legislature directed the Texas Supreme Court to adopt a rule that allows dismissal of a cause of action that has no basis in law or fact. That is the directive. The motivation behind the directive is to help the efficiency, access to the courts, and decrease the cost of litigation. But the legislature was clear. Allow for a dismissal where there is a claim that has no basis in law or fact. And that, of course, is what Rule 91A does. It does no more. Rule 91A is not, and this is where I get into GoDaddy, Rule 91A is not 12b-6 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. Those who aggressively pursue Rule 91A motions, including appellees, would have this court and others in the state believe that Texas has adopted now a 12b6 rule. We have not. GoDaddy fails because GoDaddy is based on Rule 12b6 of the federal rules. In the opinion in GoDaddy, the court specifically says that we find 12b6 to be analogous to 91A, although not identical, the court says. We find it instructive. We find it analogous. It is not. Rule 12b6, of course, is in place in a pleading standard in the federal courts that is not the same as the pleading standard in our courts. 12b6, of course, exists in a fact pleading arena in the federal courts. We in Texas do not require specific fact pleading, including the federal court's specificity requirement in pleading the cause of action of fraud, which is one of my client's causes of action against the appellees. We do not have such a strict pleading requirement in our state, but we have Rule 91A. But nevertheless, the GoDaddy court used 12b6 standard to find that dismissal was in order because threadbare facts were pled. Not enough facts were pled. Well, that flies in the face of our notice pleading rule. Our notice pleading rule does not require anything more than to put the opposing party on notice of the claims against it so that it can prepare a defense. There is, of course, a mechanism for pursuing an objection to the specificity of pleadings, and that is special exceptions. Special exceptions were not used here by the appellees. And of course, special exceptions can be filed with the original answer. Special exceptions can be filed separate from the original answer. They can be pursued immediately when the case is commenced. A hearing can be had and complaints can be made about the pleadings, and they can be the court can order a repleading. We all are familiar with that. That's not 91A. 91A tells, and I'm going to take the rule from the Bedford Internet Office Space case and Chief Justice Souter's opinion. Rule 91A requires the trial court and the reviewing court to look solely at the pleadings that are at issue. Solely the petition, the live petition from which the Rule 91A motion is taken. And then the trial court is to determine whether or not the allegations made have a basis in law or fact. But really, to state it another way, has the movement established that the plaintiff's allegations have no basis in law or fact? This inquiry is not 12b6. It is not, are there sufficient facts pled? This is not a determination of whether or not there is more than notice provided. All that we require is notice. This is not a 12b6 analysis inquiry. This is simply, does the case have merit? Is the case without merit? It is a screening process for the trial court to determine whether we can glean from the pleadings that the case does not have merit. Let me give you an example. In the inquiry about whether or not the case, the allegations of the plaintiff have basis in fact, of course, we draw all inferences in the plaintiff's favor. We assume the facts as they are pled to be true. We liberally construe the plaintiff's pleadings. All of these standards can be located in Chief Justice Souter's opinion in Bedford Internet. But we also strictly construe Rule 91, and we do nothing more than what Rule 91 91A requires. And Rule 91A does not talk about a heightened pleading standard, nor does Rule 91A talk about a supplementation to, amendment of, or a replacement of the notice pleading rules of the Texas Rules of Civil Procedure. They exist in harmony. So the inquiry by the trial court and this reviewing court, de novo review, would be reviewing in the light most favorable to the plaintiff, inferences drawn in plaintiff's favor, taking the allegations as true, liberally construing the intent of the author, the intent of the pleader, and then strictly applying what the rule requires, which is determining, is there a basis in law or fact? Does so with respect to a claim with whether or not my client's claims have basis in law. The standard is whether the allegations would, taken as true, inferences drawn in their favor, liberally construed, would entitle my client to the relief sought. It's not whether or not my client wins. It's not whether or not my clients should defeat summary judgment or a directed verdict. It's is there a basis in law? Are the allegations such that they would entitle my client to relief? We've pled all the elements of all causes of action. We've pled the facts supporting all of the elements. However, what the appellees would have this court do is take a stance that is consistent with the GoDaddy line of cases and not follow what this court has already laid down in as its standard in 2017 in the Bedford Internet case. There is another case that follows along with Justice Sutter's opinion in the Bedford case, and that is In Re Butt out of Corpus Christi. That case provides very instructive explanation and the rendition of its opinion about notice pleading and Rule 91A and how the two are to be construed together. How 91A is not a replacement for the notice pleading rule, and nor is it a 12B6 type of a rule. It is to be evaluated based on the motion to dismiss, and the pleadings made the basis for the motion are to be evaluated with that liberal deference belief and the determination of whether or not there is a cause of action that would entitle the plaintiff to relief. And those causes of action alleged by my clients are simple: fraud, and then aiding and abetting fraud and breach of fiduciary duty, along with conspiracy. There are four: fraud, aiding and abetting fraud, aiding and abetting breach of fiduciary duty, and conspiracy. All of these causes of action are recognized under Texas law. The facts that we have pled in our third amended petition, which is the live pleading at issue in this motion, lay out the story. They lay out the conduct. And speaking of conduct, when you look simply at the four corners of my client's third amended petition, you see those facts pled. You see facts that are sufficient to meet all of the elements of each of these causes of action. Aiding and abetting, of course, you need look no further than grabbing Texas, the Texas causes of action, O'Connor's, to see that that is recognized. Whether or not it's a vicarious liability claim, or it's an independent cause of action in and of itself. But using this court's approach and the in Bedford and the Corpus Christi court's approach in In Re Butt, the trial court did not follow the right standard. The trial court has looked to pleadings that are outside or documents that are outside the four corners of this pleading. Justice Sutter tells us we are to look with blinders on at the plaintiff's petition that is live. Here, the trial court clearly looked beyond by looking at the official statement that Mr. Chalice authored and Jeffries published to show that there is some type of disclaimer. That is not attached to our petition. That is attached to the plaintiff's motion, Rule 91A motion, the movement's Rule 91A motion in the trial court. That document is not part of the Third Amendment petition. And that is what GoDaddy did. GoDaddy is based solely on an immunity defense that was raised in the answer of the movement in GoDaddy. Whereas Justice Sutter pointed out in Bedford, that cannot be done. We will not do that because in Bedford, the movement won based on statute of limitations, and statute of limitations could only be derived from the answer pled by the defendant. You cannot look to a plaintiff's pleading to see the statute of limitations defense, and therefore the trial court in the Bedford case abused its discretion by looking beyond the plaintiff's pleading, beyond the four corners. Thank you.
Please, the court. Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Catherine Traceman, and along with Justice Dale Wainwright and Justin Bernstein, who's going to cover the attorney's fee issue, we represent the appellees in this appeal, Jeffries and its former employee, Matt Chalice. This is a case about the trial court's proper dismissal of plaintiffs' baseless claims against Jeffries and Chalice. I'll refer to them as the underwriters, correctly applying the Rule 91A standard. I want to give you just a very quick couple of sentence background on this litigation that you didn't hear from Mr. Ziegler. This is a case about a dispute involving the redevelopment of the old Conrad Hilton property called the Statler Hotel in downtown Dallas. It was a massive project spanning many years with many players.
I think we understand, I at least understand the okay. facts of the case. I'm curious as to what is it about the pleadings that you think would entitle your client to 91A dismissal. What's deficient about the pleadings themselves?
Sure. Well, the trial court's grant of the dismissal of 91A can be affirmed on a multitude of grounds. The deficiencies, Rule 91A claim by claim analysis, element by element analysis, and requires us looking at each and every claim. So with the court's permission, I'd like to go through the four causes of action alleged against our clients and answer your question.
And you would agree we're not looking at proof at 91A stage. We're looking only at the pleadings themselves.
Correct, Your Honor. If I may, I'd like to start with fraud. As the court knows, 91A, fraud has numerous elements, misrepresentations, falsity, reliance. If you knock out just one element, you're entitled to dismissal. I'd like to focus your attention on justifiable reliance. By their own pleadings, plaintiffs plead themselves out of this claim. Their petition states, had plaintiffs been notified of the TIF sale, that's the tax incremental financing that is the underwriting for the sale of the bonds, the many misrepresentations contained in the official statement would have been avoided. Plaintiffs can't rely on misrepresentations they don't know about. Absent reliance, there's not fraud. That's just one example, but I have compiled a list attacking each and every element of each and every claim, which is what a trial court is to do at the dismissal stage, and what this court does in affirming the trial court's decision. The next is aiding and abetting fraud, in breach of, and aiding and abetting breach of fiduciary duty. I'll group them together and talk about just one example of the deficiency in the pleading is that these two causes of action lack a basis in law. Aiding and abetting breach of fiduciary duty and fraud does not exist in Texas at this time because the Texas Supreme Court has not recognized these causes of action. And in Jewell versus Arrington, that's 936 Southwest 2nd, commencing at 640, a 1996 Texas Supreme Court decision, the court talked about if it were to recognize these kind of claims, it would do so in the context of highly dangerous activities, such as drag racing, drunk driving, reckless target shooting, not facts pled by the plaintiffs about underwriting. So that's an example of how those two claims lack a basis in law. I have compiled a list of how these causes of action lack a basis in fact, based on the pleadings, based on taking, as you stated in Bedford, taking all allegations in plaintiff's favor and taking them as true. Conspiracy is another good example.
His argument that the trial court took into consideration the official statement, which was not part of the pleadings.
Your Honor, the trial court's decision in dismissing with prejudice all the causes of action, including fraud, had nothing to do with taking into account the official statement. As I just pointed out, for example, to knock out the fraud claim, you knock out the element of justifiable reliance. There is no need to look to the official statement in order to conclude that the plaintiffs have failed to state a claim for fraud. I'd like to talk about very briefly Mr. Ziegler's argument that the trial court applied the wrong standard. The trial court correctly applied the Rule 91A standard. And notice pleading is notice pleading, and that's the law in Texas. But when a movement challenges plaintiff's pleadings on a 91A, on a Texas Rule Civil Procedure 91A basis, that involves, as we just talked about, a claim-by-claim analysis, an element-by-element of each and every claim. And so there's an important distinction between notice pleading. For example, if I'm suing for breach of contract and I write a petition and I forget to mention damages or causation, maybe the defendant does have notice pleading that I'm talking about suing him or her for a breach of contract. However, when that defendant challenges my pleading on a 91A, it is a heightened burden to demonstrate how you have satisfied the basis in law and basis in fact that the law requires, that Rule 91A requires. I would like to, because Mr. Ziegler said he's going to talk to you about two things, applying the wrong standard, which I just demonstrated the trial court applied the correct standard. He mentioned timeliness. I want to quickly cover the timeliness of the motion with the court's permission. Plaintiffs wrongly argue that the 91A motion was untimely because it was filed more than 60 days from the date of the third amended petition. Yesterday we filed with the court and we provided the court with a timeline that I think effectively demonstrates the timeliness point. Their math on how many days past the amended petition it is entirely correct, but it's also entirely irrelevant. On, as you'll see from Demonstrative Exhibit 1, in light of plaintiffs' continuous, ever-shifting claims and multiple amendments, the trial court granted a stay of the case as to the underwriters from January 23, 2018, up until the time that the court ruled on the underwriter's 91A motion to dismiss.
So you actually filed your renewed motion to dismiss during the period of the stay?
Yes, Your Honor, because we were directed to do so by the court. That's the bullet entry regarding March 23. There was a hearing on our motion for sanctions for pleadings abuse in light of this gamesmanship, constant amendments, four amendments within 4 weeks, some amendments within hours of the last amendment. We filed a motion for sanctions. The court heard that motion on March 23rd, noted a pattern of frequent amendments, ordered plaintiffs to file a proposed jury charge so that the court could know what claims they're asserting against us, and so that the underwriters could know what claims are being asserted, directed us, the underwriters, to file a motion to dismiss once.
He didn't direct you to file it. He said, if you think you have a valid motion, file it. He didn't say you must file a motion.
I agree, Your Honor. That's exactly correct. He said, file your motion if you have one. And he continued the stay as to the underwriters. And that stay continued. So from the date that the plaintiffs filed the proposed jury charge of March 26th to the time that we filed a joint renewed motion to dismiss on April 23rd, that's 28 days. The time during the stay should not be counted against the underwriters. I'm out of time. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
May it please the court, I'm Justin Bernstein, and I'll be arguing the cross appeal, which establishes that the trial court failed to award the costs and attorney's fees that the underwriters were entitled to under Rule 91A7. Plaintiffs sued for $100 million. Plaintiffs characterized their claims in their own words as, quote, the biggest fraud and heist in construction that has ever existed, perhaps in the world, certainly in the Metroplex. And plaintiffs' aggressive shotgun tactics required the underwriters to incur over 100 hours on legal services spanning over 2 years. Yet now that the underwriters are entitled to their fees, the plaintiffs are backpedaling. And they're arguing, oh, well, actually, there was no need for you to mount a serious defense in this case. There was a need. And the underwriters established through extensive evidence that they necessarily and reasonably incurred all of the fees and costs that they requested.
Well, you said that, but if you look at the billing records, they're heavily redacted on the actual tasks that were performed. I've looked at them, and many of the entries say researched, and then what the research was is completely redacted again and again and again. And of course, I understand why you would redact some of that because of strategy, and I understand, of course, why you would redact, spoke with client regarding, and you'd redact out the rest. Okay, I get that. But how is the trial court to know whether this work is redundant or necessary or reasonable if the court doesn't have any clue as to what you were researching or what you were talking to your client about?
That's a great question. So as you are probably aware, it's standard operating procedure for awards to be based on redacted invoices.
Well, it may be standard operating procedure, but I'm talking about the evidence.
Right.
I'm not saying that you should get nothing, but I'm saying how does the trial court determine the very thing that the trial court needs to determine, reasonable necessity, if the trial court does not know what you are doing? Mm-hmm. Is it a trust me situation?
So the trial court can use multiple pieces of evidence in conjunction. So the trial court had before it the entire case file and all the docket entries, and they can cross-reference that with the redacted invoices. So it's clear, and these redacted invoices show the timing and who is working on what. And so the trial court could see what was going on at that time. Did the plaintiffs just file another amended petition? Did the plaintiffs just file a request for discovery? And the many of the entries, when they needed to be, were detailed down to what motion was being worked on, the sections of that motion. And it's important in this case, especially because we may be going, it's unlikely, but it's possible that this case would continue, that we cannot reveal what legal issues that we were most concerned with and spending the most time on. So there was also testimony. We provided the affidavit of Ms. Treisman and of another co-counsel. And so that's testimony. They swore to that. They swore to the reasonableness and why they felt it was reasonable. And a co-defendant who was facing the same conspiracy allegations discussed the rate, that the rate was reasonable for this case. So taking all these pieces of evidence together, I do believe...
But when you have an expert witness, you're entitled to know the facts that underlie their opinion. And so it seems to me that the testimony that this is reasonable and customary and necessary, without sufficient support in the evidence, is just conclusory. Is just conclusory, and the other side can't even effectively challenge it. And the trial court is left with just a, well, it's because I say so. It's an ipsy dixit.
That would make sense if, let's keep in mind that the trial court awarded only $38,000 in fees, which is only 5% of the incurred fees. I believe your point could be very relevant in a close call. But here, the court has well-written, well-researched motions with hundreds of cases, and the court can
just... So you're saying with the facts of this case, it was just way too low?
Yes.
Okay.
It was an abuse of discretion and arbitrary. In this particular case, it was an arbitrary decision. It also appears it's difficult to tell what the basis was for this extremely low award, but it appears that it would be consistent with the trial court only awarding the amounts that were actually spent on drafting the motion to dismiss, which clearly contravenes Rule 91A, which states that it should award fees for any work incurred with respect to the causes of action. And the comments to the rule make clear that the motion is only one part of the work on the causes of action.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Regarding attorney's fees, just quickly, the appellees did not submit for in-camera inspection any non-redacted invoices. The affidavits presented and the fee bills presented present no more than a conclusory evidence, which is no evidence at all. And of course, the...
Do you agree that if the trial court only awarded the amount of... attorney's fees for the amount of time it took to draft the motion to dismiss and present it and so forth, that would be error?
No, and no, because it cannot be gleaned from the trial court's order.
No, I said if.
Oh, if.
If that's court. If that was the basis for the trial court's decision, that would be wrong. That the other side's actually entitled to more than just the drafting of the motion, researching the motion, and arguing the motion.
I believe that the it is within the trial court's discretion to determine what is reasonable and necessary given what the activity was in the trial court. So I'm not it is within the trial court's discretion to determine whether or not those any fees incurred as a result of researching and attending oral argument or hearings should be
on unrelated matters.
On unrelated matters, for sure. And then for related matters, I do not see that Rule 91A would make a trial court's decision in that regard error, because it's the rule simply says for reasonable and necessary attorney's fees, and that is inherent in the trial court's discretion, provided that there is evidence of reasonableness and necessity. So the answer would be no, Chief Justice. No, I do not believe so. A couple of points in reply. The Jewell versus Arrington case that appellees cite to and argue, they only got half the story right. If you read the opinion, the Supreme Court talks about And by the way, the reference in the Jewell opinion to aiding and abetting, whether or not it's a cause of action or not, which is not taken up by the court, is, of course, advisory. It's dicta. It's not even authority. The court's not going to offer an advisory opinion in this, nor would that be binding if the court did. But regardless, the Supreme Court did say that the purpose of the concert of action theory is to deter antisocial or dangerous behavior. Antisocial behavior would include fraud, which is what we had on this project. Artificially inflating a budget by $100 million when there was absolutely no whatsoever change in the design or the construction specifications for the interior finish out of this hotel, so that the owner of the hotel, who also owned the construction company doing that work, could pocket that money, and that money coming from the sale of $41 million of the $46 million TIF asset for this project is antisocial behavior. And that's why this lawsuit is being brought, because my client suffered reliance on that fraud that Jeffries and Chalice propounded. If you look at the court's record, page 392 in the Third Amendment petition.
Explain why you characterize that as antisocial behavior.
Antisocial behavior because it is, first of all, fraud is deemed, first of all, it is a crime. We know that it is. It's a white-collar crime, but it is antisocial behavior. When you are lying about the reason you need to sell your $41 million of your $46 million TIF asset, and your underwriter and the author of that underwriter don't explain to the public or to my client or notify my client that this is happening because there is an allegation that the owner has to increase the budget by $100 million because he's going to increase the upgrade of the material and the value of the hotel.
What does it do to society?
Oh, it is, first of all, it's using TIF funds that are set aside for this particular building, its project, that are taxpayer dollars. Instead of going into this developer's pocket, which is where they went, they're not going to the asset itself. That is misuse of taxpayer dollars. That's antisocial. Fraud is antisocial because fraud is a misrepresentation that causes those who are relying on that misrepresentation harm.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We appreciate your argument. This part of this case has been submitted, and those of you who are not in the argument for the next one up are free to go, or you may stay and listen to the additional argument we're going to hear in the next case.